All right, I will call this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is March 15th, 2024. We do have a quorum, and I will note for the record that we do have Representative Carroll is remote due to illness. The first item on the agenda is the minutes. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes of March 14th? Representative Finke.
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Finke moves the minutes of March 14th. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Busy day, but we're going to get through it because then a bunch of us have public safety too. Representative Feist, we will start with your bill. Would you like to move that House File 3991 be referred to the Public Safety and Policy Committee?
Yes, Madam Chair. So moved.
All right, and then I see you have an A2 amendment. Would you like to move the A2?
Yes, please.
All right, Representative Feist moves the A2 amendment. Please tell us about the A2.
Yeah, it does two things. We noticed that there was one fee for chemical dependency tests that we wanted to also eliminate. It also makes it clear that this process is not in lieu of monetary restitution. And so we wanted to make that really clear that if victims needed to be compensated, that they would be. And that this doesn't replace that system. That's basically the amendment.
All right. Any discussion to the A2 amendment? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Feist, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. The goal of this bill is to address the burden of fines and fees on children and families in the context of our juvenile justice system. By charging fees and fines, the justice system drowns youth and their families in debt. Ultimately, the system undermines community health, economic stability, and trust in our public systems. The impact of these fines and fees are long-lasting on the lives of young people. Those who cannot pay for the fees and fines face extended probation, additional court visits, the loss of or inability to obtain a driver's license, or even incarceration. As they age into adulthood, they could face civil judgments, tax and wage garnishment, and bankruptcy, any of which can impact their credit and eligibility for student loans, rental leases, or car loans. This bill addresses this issue in several ways. It encourages the use of restorative processes to satisfy the restitution obligation where available. It permits the use of restorative practices grants that we created in 2023 for the purposes of obtaining monetary compensation to satisfy restitution obligations of a child who participates in a restorative process to address them. And it eliminates several fines and fees in the juvenile justice context. Notably, these fines are not ordered or collected at levels that would have a meaningful impact on court revenues. And I've spoken with the judiciary. We don't have the fiscal note yet, but my understanding is that it's a nominal financial impact on their budget. This bill will provide additional avenues for a meaningful, victim-centered, and community-supported work service that helps youth understand their actual impact on their community. For example, by cleaning graffiti off of a business owner's wall, they actually see and they feel the impact of their behavior. The goal of the restorative process is to unpack the harm that was caused by the person's actions and attempt to make the victim whole to the extent possible. This is why restitution is an important component, particularly for people who have suffered a monetary loss. To proactively answer a few questions that have arisen, these changes, again, they don't replace the monetary restitution process where it's applicable. They simply supplement the process by providing more avenues for non-monetary restitution and sources of payment of restitution. And if a young person is given an opportunity for restorative restitution and they fail to meet those requirements, then they would just go back to the normal system. Under the normal judicial process. I really appreciate the significant bipartisan participation in our field trip to Yellow Medicine County's Restorative Justice Department during the interim. This visit highlighted the power of restorative justice to create meaningful accountability, address harm caused, and to make our community safer and our systems more just. And I have testifiers here who can make this a lot more concrete. And so I'll turn it over to them.
All right, we've got Jesse Jeppesen. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. I'm Jesse Jepson. I've been a circle facilitator in Yellow Medicine County for 12 years, and I brought
Sheena with me today, and I'll let her introduce herself.
I'm Sheena Kaufman-Foltz, a mother of the two kids that were in Circle.
Madam Chair, could they pull their mics?
Yep. Was going to let her finish talking, but yep. Yep.
I was trying to strain to hear it.
Yeah.
I figured if I'm straining.
Yeah, we don't have the best technology in here, so just make sure you speak towards the mic. That'll help.
Perfect.
Yeah, great. Go ahead. Sorry.
I'm going to let Sheena go ahead and explain to you all how I met her.
6 years ago, my boys got put in Circle for damaging some vehicles. They had to pay $5,000 in restitution, and I'm a single mother of five. So that was scary and hard to do. They gave them the option to do Circle instead of going to Prairie Lakes Detention Center, which was awesome. And then they cleaned and detailed 45 cars to pay off the restitution, and we got it down to, was it 15 or 2,000 or something, 1,500. And one of the Circle workers ended up paying and didn't tell any of us. And so that was cool. But,
awesome.
All right. Thank you for sharing that story.
Yeah. So basically, when they came into Circle, one of the factors that we struggled with was that this car they had believed was abandoned, found it in the trees behind the trailer park, and then threw a bunch of rocks at it, believing it was just kind of left there. Later in the fall, we're in an agriculture community. It was actually someone's vehicle they used to get to the beet plant when they worked in the fall. So they found it not only damaged by the rocks, but the glass was out and stuff, and the water damage had made it, like, significant damage. So he was asking for $5,000 worth of damage, which would have covered all of the fixes, except for this was a 20-year-old vehicle that couldn't be fixed, right? So there was no restitution really ordered. This was just what he wanted. So what we did is we had a Circle and used consensus to decide what was appropriate, with the victim being involved in that, and came to consensus on $1,800 being what he would be paid, which was what the vehicle on Kelley Blue Book was worth if it was in perfect condition, right? And then, like she said, one of our community volunteers anonymously paid that to the county attorney's office so he could be paid his restitution, and then we could have time, because her boys were 9 and 11 when they did this. And there was no way for them to obviously get a job and pay restitution. Like, how's this going to work? So we started with our community volunteers supervising, cleaning vehicles. A lot of the vehicles that were cleaned were our probation officers, our social workers. The kids, the boys earned $20 for each vehicle. We collected that money and paid this volunteer back. So they cleaned 45 vehicles to do that, and then just learned a lot while doing it. Her oldest son said, "This is really satisfying. I think I'm going to do this when I'm an adult." You know, he liked it, and he cleaned my car too. He was really good at it. So yeah, in the end, it was great. And in the beginning, the victim was really obviously upset about this. And when we talked to him about coming back to Circle and doing a healing circle to talk more about the incident, he just was part of the consensus decision on the phone because he was too angry to attend the circle yet. He said, "I don't think I have any reason to come. I can tell that they care. They did all this and made things right. Just tell them that I was a kid once too, and I made mistakes, and I can see they're going to do things differently." So it came together really nicely. And each of the boys wrote thank you notes to each person that they cleaned their vehicle and left it on the dash, which was very sweet of them. So I've seen a lot of good things come from it.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? If there's anybody else wishing to testify on this bill, please come up to the table now. Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, distinguished members. I am Morgan Coons. I'm the managing attorney of the Youth Prosecution Division at the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. Just have a brief statement in support of this bill. This bill balances two important aspects of juvenile justice: obtaining restitution for victims and holding respondents accountable for their actions. Restitution is necessary to repair the harm caused to victims. Youth are less able to pay restitution than adults, and so programs that provide avenues for youth to repay the harm are important parts of dispositions. Hennepin County runs a program that allows youth to complete paid work to satisfy the restitution obligations. This program has helped Hennepin County achieve very high rates of restitution recovery in juvenile cases. And this bill would help other counties build similar programs to increase juvenile justice and victims' rights statewide. At the same time, it is important that youth be held accountable for their actions. Restorative justice provides a framework within which youth can be held accountable, and the data shows it is very effective at reducing recidivism. Kids have different needs and challenges than adults, and restorative justice just simply works. Allowing youth to pay restitution while engaging in restorative programming is a smart way to balance justice for victims and programming for youth. In the same way, removing monetary sanctions for youthful offenders recognizes that fines are not effective at preventing offenses. Youth are not little adults, and we cannot treat a 13-year-old the same way as we treat a 33-year-old. Fines are not effective deterrents for juvenile offenders, they don't make victims whole, and they do not provide meaningful accountability for actions. 260B-198, the Minnesota statute that this bill would amend, already contains a litany of effective options for courts to hold youth accountable. This includes supervised probation, completion of programming, community service, restitution, enrolling in school, mental health and chemical dependency treatment. When tailoring dispositions, we need to recognize the unique character of children and find ways to make victims whole. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. All right. Not seeing any other testifiers, we'll move on to committee discussion. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker, then Representative Feist. I noticed in lines 2.11 and starting at 2.11 and 5.3, you remove the ability to charge a fine of up to $1,000 for major offenses. Do I think we need to have that much? It all depends on the case. But I'm wondering, as the last testifier said, we need to hold them accountable. If they don't participate in this program or do any of that stuff, without that availability of doing that fine and having the parents actually help make sure they're held accountable, what can be done if the fine is removed?
Representative Feist.
Thank you so much for the question. I'm going to ask Morgan if you'd like to come. You can provide a more technical answer than I could. Thanks.
Madam Chair, Representative, the 260B contains a lot of other options to hold youth accountable. Restorative justice programming would be one example, but supervised probation, I think, would be the most typical example. Having to have regular contact with the probation officer, being referred to mentorship programs, job training programs, doing community service. There are a lot of other ways besides a fine that we hold youth accountable.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker, been to the testifier. And if that doesn't work?
Mr. Koons.
You know, I think it's the same as adults, right? I mean, at some point, if the juvenile or the adult does not participate, we continue to push them and we continue to push them to participate. And at the end of the day, if they get to the end of their probation and they haven't completed stuff, you know, the court has the option to extend probation, it has the option to revoke a stay, to have an adjudication that'll stay on their record. And so I think it's the same as adults, that if they don't participate, we would just use the normal sanctions.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Feist. That's why I'm concerned about removing that, because that's an option that they can see, they can be told, if you don't do this, this is what's gonna happen. It's a way to reinforce that they need to participate and need to learn. I know when I was an officer, there's a lot of times the officers had some discretion, and we'd do these things on our own without putting the kids into the system at all. Unfortunately, a lot of times the officers aren't able to do that anymore. I'm not sure how many times we had some kids that were causing some mischief. Could I wrote them up and brought them into the system? Absolutely. But I'd call their parents, and on Saturday they'd be washing the fire trucks, especially before a parade. And they'd get that opportunity to actually be on the fire trucks during the parade and taking pride in the work they did. So I know that part of it works, but you still need that something in that background that can hold them accountable and accountable to the parents to make sure that they fulfill their obligation as well.
Representative Feist.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, it sounds like you really understand what we're trying to do here. There are mechanisms for accountability, and like the probation, where there would be terms that they would have to comply with. So, I'm so sorry, I forgot your last name.
Coons.
Coons, like Mr. Coons said. You know, children are not just little adults. We need to look at what accountability means to a 13-year-old different than we do to an adult, and the goal here is to ensure that we do that.
Representative Feist, how many 11-year-olds do you know who have $1,000?
Well, I have a 12 and a 14-year-old, and neither of them have $1,000.
Thanks. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. And I would also add that I have a 10-year-old who doesn't have $1,000, but I also would struggle to have $1,000 to pay if my child got into some trouble. But that's not the point of my comment. I just want to thank you for bringing this along. I don't love the idea of doesn't work, as though there is a sort of, you know, when children make mistakes and we involve them in the justice system, the purpose of the justice system shouldn't be to hold them into a forever relationship where it either works or doesn't work, right? We have to treat kids like kids, and we should treat adults like with compassion as well. Getting labor from children as a way to make sure that they understand the things that they have done wrong is a way for us to teach and a way for us to show a pathway forward. But criminalizing families by making them pay fines that they can't pay and then putting them into a process that can last literally for the rest of those adult and children's lives is just something that we need to recognize for what it is. We should not be putting people into debt. And I appreciate the way that this program, and I appreciate the testifiers and the Yellow Medicine model. That's clearly the route we need to go if we want our system to work. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question, as I was rereading this bill last night, Representative Feist, and I appreciate you reaching out to me on this bill, is how are we going to know if this is working or not? How are we going to know? Are there any records being kept so that we know? And these are juveniles, right? So is there some sort of summary or aggregate data that says this was the offense, this is what they did to fulfill that, this didn't work, and so they ended up having to pay the fine? Is there any record keeping at all so that we know if this is effective?
Representative Feist.
Well, we know Yellow Medicine County has had a restorative justice department for over 20 years. And so we know from their experience that it has been hugely effective in reducing recidivism. And when you look at numbers, you can see that their out-of-home placement numbers dropped like dramatically over a 10-year period. So kids who were getting into trouble, who were acting out, were able to go to like their circle process and successfully get back on track. So they, at one point, they're here, so they're going to tell me if I'm wrong about these numbers, but I believe it was like over $500,000 a year in out-of-home placement costs, and they got that down over a 10-year period to about $50,000 a year. And so they can see by those numbers that the level of disruptive children in their community dropped significantly. And they have the most, there are 17 counties in Minnesota that have some type of restorative practices in place, but they have the longest history of it. And there are some really great scholarly articles about their success. So we know that it works, that it is impactful. And, you know, we have anecdotes and we also have that data.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure I heard, like, is the legislature going to be able to have access to, you know, is this working? And trust me, I'm all for natural consequences for a kid. And, I don't see how the parent paying the $1,000 fine is holding the kid accountable at all. So I'm not opposed to what you're trying to do here. I just want to make sure that we have some data that says, you know, that this is effective. This was the consequence for the kid. I mean, I love the testimony that we heard today because there are so many life lessons that were taught in the natural consequences. I just want to make sure there's data. And then if you could clarify what circle is for the tape. I mean, I don't know for sure what that is. I have an idea. But if you could just, you know, acquaint folks with that term.
Representative Feist.
Yeah, Thank you. So I'll tell what circle is. Looks like our
We have a lot of other bills.
Oh, okay.
So if you can just give us the I can do it if you go ahead, Representative Feist.
You would talk about data. But yeah, so basically it's just a way for the person who has caused harm and if they want to, the person who has been harmed to come together in a community setting to talk through like what happened, what was the impact, and what would make the person who's been harmed whole, and what would ensure that the person who has caused that harm really understands the impact of their behavior and can make it right by them.
Yeah, I when I did AmeriCorps, we did restorative justice with kids in the St. Peter area. And, you know, it might be, you know, the teacher who observed the behavior, the parents, the community members, so it's sort of you're being held to account in front of your community instead of in a courtroom with a judge you'll never see again. And, you know, kids tend to react better to that and their peers as well. So it is, if folks are not familiar with it, I would encourage you to reach out to Yellow Medicine and learn more because it is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Any further follow-up, Representative Scott?
Madam Chair, thank you. Yeah, just again, I just wonder if there's some reporting mechanism.
And well, this bill's going to public safety, and that seems like a great possible thing to discuss as you prepare for public safety. Vice Chair Frazier, real quick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be quick. Thank the testifiers for that story. I appreciate that you sharing that. My mom with a single mom at a point, and if I had gotten that kind of situation, she would not have been able to pay that fine for me. And I agree, I don't know how much I would have learned if she just would have paid that fine for me. And Representative Johnston, thank you for sharing that story about how you would work with kids and put them in a different path versus putting them into the system. I think that is the kind of compassion and thoughtfulness we need to institutionalize. And this bill, Representative Feist, thank you for bringing it, gives us an opportunity to do that. So it's not just incumbent on the shoulders of a compassionate officer, but it is institutionalized that every child will get an opportunity to have that thoughtful, compassionate approach to accountability. Thank you.
All right. Closing comments, Representative Feist.
Thanks. I just want to again thank the experts in Yellow Medicine County and Ramsey County and Hennepin County and Pine County. Just so many experts have really contributed to this effort. It's a simple bill, but it can have a really big impact. So I urge your support.
All right. Representative Feist renews her motion to refer House File 3991 as amended to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Moeller. All right. Chair Moeller, we've got House File 4019. Would you like to recommend that House File 4019 be placed on the General Register?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that's my motion.
All right. We don't have any amendments, so please tell us about your bill. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 4019 is a Department of Public Safety Office of Justice Programs bill. It does a few things, really just more clarity. The thing that is the most relevant to this committee has to do with the data that's being collected. And I do have a testifier here from the Office of Justice Programs, and Kate Weeks is here to explain what this bill does.
All right. And while you come up here, I forgot to mention, I did bring coffee for committee members and staff. So Sergeant's office and Paige's, you also can have coffee since I made you come in on a Friday morning. Ms. Weeks, please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Kate Weeks. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Justice Programs with the Department of Public Safety. Thank you for taking the time to hear the bill this morning. This bill has three different components, and I can quickly go over them and we'll be open for questions. The first thing that this bill does is update the data practice protections over information that we get at the Office of Justice Programs. Previously, before last session, all 87 counties were responsible for processing sexual assault exam claims. Now that is all done through the Department of Public Safety Office of Justice Programs. Currently, the victim name and identifying information is private. But we want to make sure that any medical information that is also submitted with the claim also remains private. So we are asking for that classification, which also mirrors our crime victim reimbursement program, which also handles sensitive private medical information. The second provision in this bill covers just basically updating our statutes so it's all uniform across all the statutes on the definition of victim. And the third thing that this bill does is clarify that private fundraising or gifts are not considered collateral sources of payment after a violent crime. So under the Crime Victim Reimbursement Program, statute outlines things that our staff needs to consider before they make a determination on what money can be paid towards a reimbursement claim. We want to make sure that gifts such as like GoFundMe or private gifts are not included in that, because it's really, really hard for our staff to figure out, did the family actually receive those funds? So we don't want to slow down the process, and we really want to make it clear for our staff. And that is it.
All right. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Not seeing any, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be very brief. What is the effective date of the bill? Is it just August 1 default, or I'm trying to look through the bill quickly.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Scott. It doesn't have it, so I assume it defaults to the August 1st date. I'm seeing heads nodding from staff and everybody else, so I'm going to say it's August 1st.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, since this is such sensitive information, if we need to, like, make it effective sooner than that. I want to make sure that that information is not being requested and that sort of thing.
Yep. Chair Mueller.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, that's an excellent point, and I would be amenable to amending it when this bill hits the floor to make sure that happens. Thank you.
All right. Any follow-up, Representative Scott?
No.
All right. Any further discussion? All right. Closing comments, Chair Mueller.
Thank you. It's a good bill, and I appreciate your support and your catch on the effective date.
All right. With that, Representative Mueller renews her motion to recommend House File 4019 be placed on the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? All right. Motion prevails. Representative Mueller, House File 4020.
Thank you, Madam.
I was just going to say, like, pro tip, I never liked my House File numbers to be right sequential, so I would get them messed up. So sometimes you can, when you throw them in the hopper, if you put them underneath some other ones, you can mess up the order of the numbers. I'm not going to be here. I have to share all this knowledge now. Representative Mueller, would you like to recommend that House File 4020 be placed on the General Register?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that's my motion.
All right, and I don't see any amendments. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So this is also an agency bill, Department of Public Safety. It's a Bureau of Criminal Apprehension bill, and I have Drew Evans here from the BCA to explain what it does.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. This, too, is a relatively straightforward bill, and I'll explain very quickly what it does. The BCA maintains the predatory offender registration system for the state of Minnesota for those individuals that have been determined to register based on the laws in the state of Minnesota. There's been two challenges that we've identified as part of this, and our main goal with this system is to ensure offender compliance with that. And these two provisions would ensure that additional people would maintain their compliance. The first would expand options for allowed verifying offenders once they've moved out of the state of Minnesota. There are situations where offenders move to a different state, they're compliant in that other state, and for a variety of different reasons, they become non-compliant in Minnesota based on the narrow ways that we can ensure or verify their compliance in a different state. For example, we'd be allowed with the changes to confirm an offender's updated registration with another state's public website, through local law enforcement that would verify they're compliant in that state, and through confirming their residence through another state's incarceration, probation, public health, or motor vehicle records showing that they're in that other state. And the second situation would allow us to submit registration materials on behalf of an individual in circumstances where the registrant is without the capability or capacity to submit it themselves. Think of an individual who's in a coma, for example, or is incapacitated for some other reason. Right now, a conservator, a guardian, or other individual with power of attorney cannot fill out their verification paperwork that is required every year. And so this would allow those individuals in the categories I just mentioned to fill out that paperwork so that we can maintain compliance with that individual. And that's really the gist of the bill, Madam Chair and members. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
All right. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Doesn't look like it. We'll move on to member discussion. Oh, Representative Grossel.
Madam Chair, I guess for the author, maybe, or either one of you, I guess, Superintendent, what is the liability on Guardian, on the Guardian Conservative for not completing the registration?
Whoever wants to take it.
Madam Chair, Representative Grossel, I don't know that this provision would create any additional responsibility. The individual would still be determined to be non-compliant if they didn't fill this out. So the liability, if that's the determination, would still remain on the individual. They would show non-compliant. If they're incapacitated for some reason, there's obviously, it would be unlikely that prosecution would be pursued, but the guardian themselves would not be placed in a situation where they would be held responsible for the non-compliance. It would still be on the offender themselves.
Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick follow-up. How would we then complete or bring that person into compliance, or how would we then make sure that that record is closed up, or you know what I'm talking about?
Superintendent.
Madam Chair, Representative Grossel, I think in that particular situation, what we typically do is we have agents and then we work with our local partners as well who do a lot of compliance checks. We go through a series of processes trying to work. So if we had a guardian that's listed, for example, if this passes, we would be contacting the guardian trying to ensure that they fill out that paperwork. And we would work through that process knowing that that individual is incapacitated and trying to make sure that we get that done. If that becomes a problem down the line, it's certainly something we could re-examine and address if we found guardians on a regular basis not filling out that paperwork when they're the person that's indicated they'll be responsible for it. But we would, through the process, trying to get them into compliance that way.
All right. Any further discussion? All right. Closing comments, Chair Mueller.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, members. This, too, is a good bill, and I neglected to mention at the beginning that I've worked closely with Representative Rarick on a whole host of sexual assault issues, and then this year we're working together on a couple of predatory offender registration bills, and I'm thankful for her work on that and her co-authorship. It's a good bill. Please vote yes.
All right. With that, Representative Mueller renews her motion to recommend that House File 4020 be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, Representative Greenman. It's the Representative Greenman show.
Morning.
I thank you for being willing to have all your bills up. I didn't want to make multiple people come in at a Friday morning if I didn't have to. So
I appreciate that.
So first up, we've got House File 3957. So I will move to recommend that House File 3957 be placed on the general register. Representative Greenman, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an OSHA, M&OSHA technical bill that clarifies and modifies a few provisions in Minnesota OSHA law. It affects the warehouse worker bill that we passed last year, the OSHA review board, the ergonomic standard, and the ability to share data with local law enforcement. And I have a member, someone from the department who can go through it. I don't know if you want to do that now, or I think that there was an amendment on the bill as well.
Yep, let's go ahead and present the bill as you brought it forward, and then we can get to the amendment.
Thank you.
So I've got Laura Zajac. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair, Representatives. My name is Laura Zajac. I'm Chief General Counsel at the Department of Labor and Industry. Appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3957. I'll start with Section 2. This change to Section 182.664, which governs the Occupational Safety and Health Review Board, makes clear that public meetings and hearings can be closed for deliberation of the board members and consultation with their Assistant Attorney General. In accordance with their practice. The board is a lay board that makes quasi-judicial determinations on contested OSHA matters. Their meetings are open for arguments of the parties and questioning of the parties that are, it's cases that are on appeal either from the Office of Administrative Hearings or on a petition from a final order of MnOSHA. So similar to how appellate judges deliberate after an oral argument, the board members benefit from the opportunity to have a closed meeting where they ask questions of their counsel, ask questions about the strengths and weaknesses of each party's position and potential policy concerns before the meeting would be reopened where they would vote and render their decision. Similar language was passed last year in relation to the Public Employment Relations Board, which is at 179A.041 subdivision 10. That's a board that's similar in structure. It also has three lay board members, one representing the public, public employers, one representing public employees, and one representing the public. At Section 3, the changes to the Review Board's authority are proposed in response to a Minnesota Supreme Court decision issued last year, the Trinity decision. The Trinity decision was interpreting Section 14.62 and held that the Commissioner of the Department of Human Services did not have the ability to remand to an administrative law judge. The same issue that the court addressed in Trinity is also presented in the language of the Review Board statute. Currently, there's no explicit ability for the board to remand to an administrative law judge, but the board has proceeded until the Trinity decision on the assumption that they did have this authority. So revisions to the section would go back to the pre-Trinity thought, and then revisions would also clarify the board's authority when a party files a petition to vacate a final order related to occupational safety and health. At Section 4, the proposal fills a gap in existing law by providing that all appeals from the OSHA Review Board to the Minnesota Court of Appeals are covered by the Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act, which is Chapter 14, including appeals of board decisions regarding petitions to vacate final orders of the commissioner. It's already clear that when a party appeals from an Office of Administrative Hearings matter, that that's the procedure you follow, but there is no prescribed procedure when a party appeals directly from a decision of the commissioner. At Section 5, the amendment concerns penalties for MnOSHA citations. Current law provides the factor that MnOSHA uses when issuing these penalties. The additional language proposed explains that the general factors for agency penalties, which are found in 14.045 subdivision 3, do not apply as the more appropriate specific factors have been identified in Chapter 182. The last section for me to cover today is Section 6. Section 6 provides, Sections 182.667, excuse me, provides for criminal penalties in existing law, including when an employer willfully or repeatedly violates MnOSHA standards. The language we've proposed clarifies that MnOSHA may share its investigative or inspection data with a city or county attorney's office who would have criminal jurisdiction over those penalties. This would ensure that agencies with criminal prosecution authority can adequately consider whether criminal charges should be filed and promote sufficiency. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'm available to stand for questions.
All right. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Not seeing any. We'll move to, there is an amendment filed, so we'll move on to the amendment. Representative Scott Anderson, that's your amendment.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. And before I offer the amendment, Madam Chair, if I could just ask the testifier a quick question.
Yep.
Thank you. If you could articulate, I noticed that these hearings are open to the public except for when they're deliberating. You're asking for that to be, only that part of it to be not subject to the open meeting law. But could you tell me what kind of information is discussed in those meetings? What kind of data might be shared that would make it so that it needed to be excluded from open meeting laws?
Chief General Counsel.
Thank you, Chair, Representative. My understanding of those conversations is that they are really a blend between things that are attorney-client privileged, because the board members are trying to understand what are usually very technical OSHA cases that have been before an administrative law judge. So they have the record before them. They've just heard in open meeting the arguments between the parties. And so they're diving in and asking questions of their assistant attorney general to understand the case before them, and at the same time that's blended with certain policy deliberations as well about what they feel are the strengths and weaknesses of the case.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's so much data being shared in all these bills today that it's just really concerning to me. And when I see, you know, something, language that's new language that says, no, you're not open to, or you're not subject to the open meeting law, it makes alarms go off in my head. So, Madam Chair, based on that answer, I'm going to withdraw the amendment. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So we'll move on to general discussion of the bill. Member discussion. All right. Closing comments, Representative Friedman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate this is, again, a technical bill that I think updates and clarifies and modifies, so appreciate your support.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion to recommend House File 3957 be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. All right. Now we'll move on to House File 3527. I will move to refer House File 3527 to the Ways and Means Committee. Representative Greenman, I understand you have an A4 amendment.
I do.
All right. Would you like me to take care of that first?
I would. Thank you.
Great. All right. I will move the A4 amendment to House File 3527. Representative Greenman, please tell us about the A4.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment contains some updates and clarifications and revisions based on some of the concerns and conversations we've had with local governments and the Secretary of State. It also aligns the democracy canon with Minnesota's case law and clarifies some ambiguities. The other thing I'd note is it requires the states to be joined as a necessary party in areas where the violation being challenged is one that local subdivisions don't have discretion over.
All right. Any discussion to the A4 amendment? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Greenman, please tell us about your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for two of three bills today. So I'm glad to be here, especially presenting this, the Minnesota Voting Rights Act, which codifies, streamlines, and strengthens the protections of Section 2 of the Federal Voting Rights Act and puts it into Minnesota law. The Voting Rights Act of 1965, which the DOJ called the single most effective piece of civil rights legislation ever passed by Congress, works to ensure that the right to vote and participate that are guaranteed in the 14th and 15th Amendment are not denied because of race. That is the goal also of the Minnesota Voting Rights Act, to guarantee here in Minnesota the equal opportunity to participate and vote in our political process. It enshrines these protections into Minnesota law that have always been important, but has become especially urgent because of an Eighth Circuit decision that upended decades of precedent to hold that Minnesotans themselves can no longer challenge racially discriminatory laws and redistricting plans under the Federal Voting Rights Act. This decision comes in a long line of federal court cases that have weakened parts of the Federal Voting Rights Act. In a second, I'm going to turn it over to testifiers to provide some detail about specifically how we strengthen, codify, and streamline these provisions into Minnesota law with a focus on the rights of action and judicial remedies under this committee's jurisdiction. But I just want to take a minute to ground us in why we should do this and why we should do this now. Minnesota has taken great strides to establish a system of free and fair elections and pro-voter election rules. But like many other metrics in Minnesota, significant racial disparities still exist in voting participation and representation in our political system. Minnesota's history of public and private discrimination against Native Americans, people of color, and language minority voters, and the racial disparities that persist to this day continue to impair the opportunities of Minnesotans to fully and equally participate in our process. As the Minnesota House Select Committee on Racial Justice reported, Minnesota's persistent racial disparities are some of the, quote, some of the worst in the nation, measured by racial gaps across systems in unemployment, income, wealth, incarceration rates, arrest rates, and the list goes on for another couple of sentences. These racial disparities exist in voter participation as well. According to the Minnesota, in the U.S. Census, in 2020, 79% of white citizens voted, only 66.1% of black citizens voted, 66% of Asian citizens, 62.7% of Latino citizens, and the average voter turnout in majority Native voter districts was 49% in 2020. This bill is drafted to ensure Minnesotans have access to a private right of action with strong legal protections against voter suppression and vote dilution in Minnesota. We've learned a lot from the six other states that have already adopted state voting rights acts and incorporated what we've learned from them to strengthen protections for voters while streamlining it and providing an opportunity to fix the discriminatory practice before and without going to court. The Minnesota Voting Rights Act will codify those protections against racial discrimination and strengthen the process for voters to protect their rights and opportunities to elect a candidate of their choice in Minnesota. With that, Madam Chair, I'm going to turn it over to testifiers. I will say that we had a third testifier, and I will not read his testimony in, but had a hard time getting here. But he was a voter who testified in the last committee. In elections, we heard a lot more testimony. His name is Khalid Omar, and he lives in Bloomington. And what he describes himself as is a leader, a husband, an organizer, who's organizing the Muslim community and for many years has educated people about their rights to vote and translating the polling locations. And what he talked about is over the years that he's been doing that, he's seen elders in particular deny their right to interpretation at the polls, leaving folks feeling frustrated and excluded from the process. He's also heard from other folks across the state and acknowledges that the stark racial disparities in folks who register and who turn out impact folks' participation. And he urges the committee to take stories like his and others who can't be here today into consideration. So if you're interested in some of that testimony, we heard it in elections. And with that, I think we have two testifiers. And I'd ask for Asim Mulji from Campaign Legal Center, who can maybe get a little bit more into the substance of the bill.
All right. I have Asim Mulji, and then I have Terry Nelson on deck. If I tell you you're on deck, if you can come on up one of these chairs so we can keep things moving, that'd be great. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Asim Mulji. I'm a voting rights lawyer at the Campaign Legal Center. We're an organization that advances democracy through law and happened to settle the first case brought under the Washington State's Voting Rights Act. I'm going to give a little tour of the provisions of the bill, but before I do, I want to make one note about the need. As it stands, Minnesota law protects voters or individuals from discrimination, racial discrimination, in all sorts of areas of public life, public accommodations, education, employment, and often it does so layering on protections and enhancing protections that are provided by federal law already. But it doesn't do that with voting, which is arguably one of the most important areas of civic life. And as a result, there's currently no state law in Minnesota addressing racial discrimination in voting. This bill would allow Minnesota to join the growing number of states that are filling this gap, and it does so by codifying protections of the Federal Voting Rights Act, clarifying them where necessary, and in some circumstances, strengthening them. So what's in the bill? I'll tick through them as quickly as I can. Like the Federal Voting Rights Act, this bill includes a cause of action for voters to challenge what's called voter suppression. These are policies and practices that impair ballot access and result in material disparities based on race and other protected characteristics. It's called vote denial in the federal context. This is stuff like closing polling places in communities of color, holding elections at odd times that tend to result in disparate turnout in communities of color. Second, like the Federal Voting Rights Act, this bill includes a cause of action to challenge what's known as vote dilution. This is a means to challenge things like gerrymandered maps that crack and peck voters in a community, things like election systems that tend to result in a dilution of minority voting power. Third, the bill requires pre-suit notice, and this is new. This is something it added. It requires voters who are affected to provide pre-suit notice to jurisdictions and allows jurisdictions time to fix the problem before you resort to costly litigation. This is an innovation on the federal VRA, and we strongly support it. Fourth and finally, remedies. The bill empowers state courts to consider remedies proposed by all parties and to choose the one that's best tailored to fix the problem. This sounds like a no-brainer, but it actually corrects a really strange quirk in practice in federal courts of deferring to the remedy proposed by the local government that was found to be in violation in the first place. So we believe that all of these provisions would protect Minnesotans' right to be vote free from racial discrimination, and we urge you to adopt this bill.
All right, thank you. Next up, I have Terry Nelson.
Good
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Teresa Nelson, and I'm legal director for the ACLU of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today in support of House File 3527. Minnesota has a significant reputation for safe, clean, and well-administered elections, and we routinely have some of the highest voter turnout in the nation. So why, you might ask, do we need a Minnesota Voting Rights Act? Because even a well-run election system can have persistent problems that require systemic tools to fix. Minnesota is high on the list in almost every quality of life indicator. It's a great state to live in, except that good life is not enjoyed equally by people of color. For people of color, as Representative Greenman already noted, there are persistent widespread racial disparities in every aspect of life. And given those systemic inequalities, we would be willfully blind to ignore the likelihood that there are also systemic inequalities that permeate our elections. Passing an affirmative state voting rights act is therefore an important step to ensure that we have the tools needed to address those systemic inequalities. And the provisions of House File 3527 are designed to do just that. And this bill would provide a clear process to address voting rights issues in Minnesota. And just as Minnesota has a proud tradition of crafting legal protections that are stronger than the U.S. Constitution and federal law, we should not settle for the federal protections that exist on voting rights. And I want to close with a quick note about the pre-filing notice provisions. I speak from direct experience when I say that putting together broad impact litigation on civil rights issues such as voting rights is a heavily resource-intensive activity. And as an attorney, I've got an ethical duty to not bring frivolous claims. And so that means putting in a significant level of attorney time to marshal facts and evidence, to conduct legal analysis, retain expert witnesses, work with plaintiffs to help them navigate the legal system. And just by way of example, one of our voting rights cases took approximately 2 years for us to put together. And so given those resources that are needed prior to filing, the modest cost reimbursement provisions of House File 3527 are entirely reasonable. So thank you again. I urge you to vote in favor of House File 3527.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? I'll also note, members, there are quite a few letters in your packets as well. And this, as Representative Greenman noted, this bill did already go to the Elections Committee. Seeing no further testifiers, we'll move on to committee discussion. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Greenman, for the conversations we've had on this. And I wanted to start by kind of honing in on where I think there is potentially a real a place for something in this bill that maybe we should work on at the state, and that's the concept of vote dilution in city and county elections. And the local government letter talked about some concerns about the way that the shift to potentially ward elections is set up. And I just wanted you to talk a little bit about some of the operational challenges that local governments are going to have to go through if they are, if there is a vote dilution problem and ways that they can remedy that, either under your bill or under current law, or, maybe there's a, I would think there might be a better approach even where we could make some sort of streamlined but still democratic process. To maybe move towards, if that's necessary in a city, to deal with vote dilution issues.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Niska. And I really appreciate the conversations we've had and thinking about this piece, because I think one of the things you're referring to for folks who haven't been a part of those conversations is one of the vote dilutions issues that can happen is if you have at-large elections in a relatively diverse area, which means that the whole population is electing folks. But if you have polarized voting, which is one of the requirements to show a violation under the statute, you may end up in a situation where you have 40% of the local jurisdiction is our communities of color, and if there's polarized voting, they may end up not being able to elect any people of their choice to the council or to the legislative body at that local level. And one of the things in this bill, out of those conversations, is that currently under Minnesota law, that statutory cities cannot go to ward elections, which may be one of the remedies under if you're found to have violated the vote dilution provision. They can't do it on their own without becoming a charter city. And so one of the provisions in this bill, and we'll talk about it in state government, finance is allowing statutory cities a process to do that on their own. And some of that is coming out of the conversation that I think you and I share, which is where it's possible for locality. The goal here is to ensure that everybody can participate, right? The goal here is to eliminate discriminatory practices and procedures, whether or not that they were intentional. And in things like that, we want to make sure that, that local jurisdictions have all the tools that they can. And so I think that that's part of the reason that out of those conversations that we're also doing that so that folks can change. What I will say is, and I think reflecting some of our conversation, is we aren't able to proactively, and I think that the history of civil rights laws, I think the history of particularly voting rights laws, is we aren't able to proactively identify each and every place that that we're going to see the discriminatory effects in our system. So I think the purpose of this bill and the goal is to solve the problem, not to create more litigation. I think we also need to ensure that voters who may be experiencing this have some rights and remedies, and so we're trying to strike the right balance.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. Thank you for that answer. And I what I would say, I think, is this bill is both too broad in trying to use a hammer in a lot of other areas, and in that particular area, I don't think it is quite there, and maybe it will get there or closer to it in state government elections. I do think, and I think that there is a real potential use for something like this in that specific vote dilution context, where maybe we need to find a mechanism to encourage and facilitate counties and cities to solve that problem, and even potentially create a remedy if they don't. But I think a lot of the fundamentally, I think a lot of the concept of this bill as it applies to some of the other disparity issues that were identified, it's just the wrong tool. And it's the wrong tool because it's taking a tool that is only a workable or necessary tool at the federal level because of the difference between the federal government and the state government. And, we don't have a federal election system. That's why we have the 14th and 15th Amendments, and that's why we have to have a Voting Rights Act at the federal level to allow people to enforce the 14th and 15th Amendments against the states. We do have a state election system, and all of the cities and counties are essentially agents of us at the legislature, and we set the election policy. So, in the same way that we wouldn't accept if a city or if a company said, yeah, our employees are doing a bad thing, but instead of us telling them to stop or telling them to change, why don't you sue our employees? We wouldn't accept that. In the same way, I don't think that the folks that they're asking for change from the state legislature should accept us as a state legislature saying, well, yeah, if the cities and counties following our directions are doing something bad, sue them and get them to change. We should be dictating the election policy here, and to the degree that we can find and identify problems, and maybe vote dilution is a problem in some places, and we should deal with that. And to the extent that, other things that cities and counties are doing to implement the election policy that we have established, to the extent those are, resulting in vote suppression, we should identify those problems and give them different instructions on how to carry that out. So, the Voting Rights Act is a hammer, and it needs to be a hammer because that's the only tool the federal government has against states. We have the scalpel. We have all of the tools. We get to do, tell them to do everything. And so I think that this is just fundamentally the wrong tool because it's trying to look at this federal Voting Rights Act model and import it into a place where we don't need to use that model. We have much better tools. So ultimately, I think the struggle that the city and local, the counties and cities are having, the local governments are having, is that we're sort of making them the targets of litigation, and potentially, it's sort of perversely, it's an anti-democratic situation because we're putting policy questions about how elections are administered into court cases. Sometimes those court cases are decided by a judge, again, not a democratic actor. Sometimes those court cases are decided because of collusive litigation between, political actor and a public official who maybe has political sympathies for those actors. That happens on both sides of the aisle. It's happened in Minnesota more recently on the left side of the aisle, but it's possible and happens on both sides of the aisle. And I think that this, you know, ends up funneling some of these things that, again, should be made, decisions that should be made transparently and accountably here at the legislature, and funneling them into a different process. So for that reason, you know, I think there are some good here that we could work on, but I don't think this is the right model of the way to do it. Thanks.
All right. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. Sorry, I forgot to release the mute. I just have a question for you on page 2. Subdivision 8, the protected class, 2.24. It says protected class means a class of citizens who are members of a racial, color, or language minority group or members of a federally recognized Indian tribe. Is there a reason that other protected groups are not included in this? And are we only doing federally protected groups or state protected groups?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Finke. We took, because of the narrow needle of threading around these issues that the federal courts have left in terms of how it relates to dealing with issues of race and really tracking them to the long both history of the Voting Rights Act and to the disparities in our and laws in our country, we took this directly from the federal Voting Rights Act. It is a great question of what we can do to ensure that we are that our laws and our state laws are responding that. I think we should look at that. I know we got to be like, there's a sort of a part of the reason of incorporating definitions is we're sort of bringing in what we know legally and sort of in jurisprudence we can do. But I do think it's a good question that we should think about.
Any follow-up, Representative Figge?
Thank you, Chair. And I appreciate that. I'll just say that, you know, I know that we have historically seen immense disparities in our voting rights. And our voting access, and we are also seeing new and creative ways to create future disparities for certain communities. People who change their name, for example, are being denied access to the ballot. So I think it's just something we want to keep in mind.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, thank you. I agree with Representative Greenman. I believe she said, you know, when this bill goes to state gov, but I think the motion was to send it to Ways and Means. And I agree with her that it should go to state gov. This is really affecting our locals.
We've got a good answer for you.
Yeah.
Oh, I had the same question, Representative Greenman.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. When I, in terms of jurisdiction, the piece that needs to go to state gov is the ward piece, and that's going directly there. So we sent that provision as a standalone there. That is, after talking to the chairs, what we discussed.
There's a clone, is my understanding. So it is going, that language is going to be vetted by the state government committee. Representative Scott.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure it wasn't a separate bill with just that piece, but it's the entire bill so that it could be seen in context.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, it is that provision. And after going through the bill, because of the jurisdiction of this bill, they said they didn't need to see the bill until we added that clone language or that ward language, and that's what we sent there.
Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I don't think that maybe is the right approach here because this, as Representative Niska laid out, this is really affecting our local units of government more broadly than just that one section. So, I just think that's wrong-headed. So, but we're not judged.
I'm not the chair of the state government committee. So, and it has been vetted in the elections committee as well. Any further discussion to the bill? All right, Representative Greenman, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I really appreciate this conversation. I appreciate the conversations we've had, and I appreciate the idea that what we are doing here is trying to ensure that everybody has equal access to our elections and that we have a robust democracy. I think as we think and look and find ways that folks are being discriminated against, that our laws and practices have disparate impacts, we should be looking at closing those. We are better when everybody participates and everyone has access to elect the people of their choice. And so I'm going to continue to keep working on that, and I hope you will join me. Thank you.
All right. I will renew my motion to re-refer House Bill 3527 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Greenman, you still have to stay here. I will move House File 4444 be placed on the General Register, and then would you like me to move the A8?
Yes.
All right. I will move the A8 amendment. Representative Greenman, please tell us about the A8.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment was made based on a lot of conversations that we've been having with particularly employer groups since this was heard. This got an hour and 45 minutes of hearing in the Labor Committee. A few things, just I'll note that what it does is it updates the individual liability to narrow who will be liable, and it clarifies that they must be people who are engaged in prohibited activities. It removes the recovery or removes the minimum penalty amounts, and it updates the independent contractor construction test based on stakeholder feedback. And the last thing it does is it strikes language that would establish the failure to produce information as a waiver of a defense.
All right. I will note that we don't have an hour and 45 minutes, and we're going to keep our discussion to the provisions that brought the bill before us. Any further discussion to the A8? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Greenman, please tell us about your bill as amended, and I know we do have quite a few testifiers on this one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to clarify, because I was on the third bill, did you say this was going to be re-referred to taxes?
I believe the motion was the General Register. Would you like me to amend my motion?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. So I will amend my motion, and the motion is that we'll move to recommend House File 4444 be re-referred to the Taxes Committee. All right. So now it's properly before us.
Thank you.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a bill that has a great number to remember, and it strengthens protections for Minnesota workers, law-abiding businesses, and taxpayers by improving Minnesota's ability to fight worker misclassification fraud. For the purposes of this committee, I'll try to focus on the pieces of legislation under the jurisdiction of this committee, specifically the private right of action, the data protections, and the civil remedies. But before I turn it over to Labor Commissioner Blissenbach to give a few more details about the policy, I want to start and ground us in why this bill is so necessary. And that's why we had an hour and 45 minutes. We had a lot of testifiers, a lot of workers, some of whom are here today, who talked about why this bill was so necessary. Minnesota has a long tradition of providing and protecting economic security, workplace freedom, and a social safety net for generations of Minnesotans that have come to expect and rely on that. All of this is put at risk when workers are misclassified as independent contractors when they should be employees. When you're an employee, you get minimum wage and overtime. You get access to unemployment insurance if you get laid off, workers' compensation if you get injured at the job, and now paid time off and soon paid family and medical leave. And if you face discrimination on the job, you have laws to protect you. Now, there are people who are self-employed, solo businesses, freelancers, who earn business for themselves, where they negotiate the terms, the payment, and the scope of each contract and job, where they can make a profit or loss, where each contract, where they can build a book of business and a customer base. Those folks are independent contractors, and the law treats them as such. But when you're misclassified as an independent contractor but still doing the work of an employee, you're cheated out of all of those protections that I talked about, plus you pay your boss's share of payroll taxes. Misclassification also, as we heard from testimony, harms law-abiding businesses that have to compete against companies that artificially reduce their costs by cheating their workers and Minnesota taxpayers. The truth is, misclassification fraud is a huge problem, and it's only growing. Yesterday, if you're a labor nerd, you may have seen that the OLA report came out on worker misclassification, the 2024 report, and it showed that since the 2007 report, misclassification has only been growing, with 22% of employers in Minnesota have misclassified at least one worker. Now, that is because we can't actually show how big of a problem this is, and it's conservative estimates. By any measure, the gig economy and the fissured workplace, the problem is only growing. That's why last year the Attorney General's office convened a set of Minnesotans. I was on the task force. I am on the task force. Workers, member of the business and freelancer community, experts, lawmakers, and our agencies who have spent the last 6 months listening to workers and businesses, learning from the enforcement agencies, and trying to understand this problem. And one thing is clear. Our current policy approach is to detecting, to preventing, and to punishing misclassification is not working. It's fractured, disjointed, and doesn't give our agencies or Minnesota workers the tools they need to address this problem. We have been working with Commissioner Blissenbach, with Deputy Deed Commissioner Evan Rowe, with Department of Revenue Commissioner Markert, with the AGO's office, and with members of the task force and others to come up with a set of recommendations, which we adopted in January and turned into this bill. So I will just conclude with one thing is clear on this problem, and it was clear in the OLA report yesterday. It was part of their recommendations. It was clear from the task force, and I think it's been clear for a while. This is a whole of economy problem, and we need a whole of government approach to this problem, and that's what this bill does. And so with that, Madam Chair, I think I'd like to ask Commissioner Blissenbach to come down and talk a little bit more about the bill.
Commissioner, please come up, and then I've got Bert Johnson on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Nicole Blissenbach. I serve as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you, chairs and members of the committee. I'm here to testify in support of House File 4444, the bill addressing employer misclassification fraud. Misclassification fraud has a significant impact on employees, law-abiding employers, taxpayers, and social safety net programs. Currently, the law addresses misclassification in a very piecemeal approach and does not set government up to successfully address the problem or prevent the problem from growing. This is clearly shown in the report issued by the Office of Legislative Auditor yesterday. This legislation specifically addresses deficiencies in the law meant to address general misclassification and misclassification in the construction industry. Many of the changes outlined in the legislation are direct responses to challenges DLI has faced and experienced in enforcing the current law. The legislation provides more clarity, which will promote compliance and allow investigations to be more impactful. It streamlines and expands enforcement authority and strengthens the consequences for employers who violate the law. The legislation also establishes a misclassification enforcement and education partnership. This partnership, made up of DLI, Deed, Revenue, Commerce, and the Attorney General's Office, will ensure an effective and efficient whole-of-government approach to misclassification by streamlining the investigation and enforcement activity. This legislation, specific to DLI, will help combat misclassification throughout the state, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of the bill.
All right. Thank you for being here. All right. I've got Bert Johnson up next and Matt Ealing on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. My name is Bert Johnson. I'm General Counsel for the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters, representing over 12,000 carpenters and affiliated trades throughout Minnesota. House File 4444 addresses misclassification, which is the single largest threat to the existence of middle-class jobs in the construction industry in Minnesota. As a country and as a state, we have premised all of our rights and economic security in the workplace to be free from discrimination, to earn overtime pay, to form a union, social security, work comp, unemployment insurance, health care, squarely on the employment relationship. So when employees are misclassified as independent contractors, unscrupulous employers are shifting the costs of those protections and the risks of working without them down to the most marginalized workers in our industry. By doing so, these unscrupulous employers gain a competitive advantage in an industry driven by low bid. I serve on the AG's task force, as Representative Greenman mentioned, where we received testimony from several of the workers, of the many workers in the construction industry who were paid low wages in cash, sustained injuries, and were subjected to threats and exploitation. We also heard from employers about how difficult it is to compete against competition taking advantage of the lack of penalties and deterrence against misclassification. Yesterday, the OLA study report revealed that since the previous study in 2007, misclassification in the construction industry grew from 15% to 23%. The OLA report recommends information sharing and strategic investigations like the partnership that the commissioner just mentioned across departments, increased penalties for violations, and other recommendations that are addressed in the bill. And then in closing, I'd say I applaud Commissioner Blissenbach and her staff for their hard work on putting as many reforms to investigations in place prior to the OLA report as they could and on this bill. I'd also like to thank Commissioner Blissenbach and Representative Greenman for listening to the constructive input from employers that are reflected in the amendment, which I believe makes this bill a lot better. Thank you for hearing me, and I urge support of it. Thank you, Chair.
All right, thank you. Matt Ealing is up next, and I've got Peter Coyle on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Greenman, members. Matt Ealing with the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. Very briefly, Madam Chair and members, we are interested in removing lines 17.18 and 17.19 from the bill for the following reasons. The various state agencies and state-level entities that comprise the new partnership that's created by the bill are all subject to the Data Practices Act, which is our state's open records statute. Now, however, if those lines on 17.18 and 17.19 pass into law, they will sow confusion about the coverage of the act as it extends to the data of this newly formed entity. And so whatever the original purpose of including this language, we feel that the net effect, and this is our concern, the net effect will be to try to create confusion when Data Practices Act requests come in for data that's pertinent to this new entity. As someone who spent the last two decades requesting government information and who has been a plaintiff in open records litigation against entities as varied as the Minneapolis Police Department to the Department of Justice, I've seen one common tactic, and that's for the government to use linguistic uncertainty or the perception of linguistic uncertainty to avoid their disclosure requirements under law. And so to avoid that uncertainty, the legislature can speak very, very clearly and plainly about the coverage of this new entity's data under the Data Practices Act. And that will allow the public to access important information about the educational and policy activities of the new partnership, while at the same time allowing the partnership to share and utilize active investigative data in a protected manner as allowed today by Sections 1339 and 1382. If there is a specific type of investigative data that Representative Greenman or one of the departments are concerned about, we are certainly open to talking about some clarifying language, but we would like to see the broad language on 17.18 and 17.19 removed. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Peter Coyle, and then I have Laura Ziegler on deck. And thank you to the last two testifiers for keeping it right at 2 minutes. I appreciate you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair, representatives, members of the committee. My name is Peter Coyle. I'm a lawyer lobbyist with Larkin Hoffman, and I represent Housing First Minnesota today in committee. Housing First is the state's largest trade association representing the interests of home builders, their subcontractors, suppliers, and other vendors that are active in the economy. The housing construction footprint in Minnesota is substantial. And we have members that are working in all of your committees, your communities, I'm quite sure. It's a disappointment, therefore, that the housing industry was not actively invited to be part of the task force process that underlies this bill as it's presented to you today. In fact, we just heard about the text of the bill when it was introduced just 2 weeks ago, and this is the third committee stop. The legislature is actively working on housing policy to promote affordability. And unfortunately, in our opinion, this bill goes in the opposite direction. And I say that with respect to the sincerity of the author and the advocates of the bill who are trying to address a problem that we acknowledge is real. But the task force itself, as represented by the OLA report that was just released yesterday, doesn't substantiate the need to amend the worker classification statute in the manner that it's proposed today. In fact, the OLA report only relies on limited data from deed to indicate that there's a problem within the deed definition. It doesn't substantiate the need to modify the independent contractor statute as it relates to the construction industry. And had we been part of the task force process, we could have offered information that would have helped inform that process. Again, I respect the advocacy's point of view about this, but I think the data doesn't support it. But the OLA does say important things that we do agree with and which are reflected in the bill, and I want to make that clear. The OLA report encourages more coordinated enforcement. We agree. It encourages enhanced enforcement, and this bill includes that type of authority, and we agree. But we respectfully urge the committee to not adopt Section 8 of the bill because we think that the data and, frankly, the law doesn't substantiate the need for really dramatic changes as this bill proposes. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. I have Laura Ziegler. And then if there's anyone else from the public wishing to testify on this bill, if you could come up right now, that would be great. All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Laura Ziegler with Associated General Contractors. I serve as the Director of Highway Heavy and Government Affairs there. AGC of Minnesota represents over 350 commercial contractors. These are general contractors, subcontractors, and suppliers. For the purposes of this discussion, our members are commercial contractors, so we do not do single-family residential construction. And additionally, over 80% of our contractors are union-affiliated and signed to a collective bargaining agreement. It is our belief, and I believe the intent of many people addressing this issue, is to hold the bad actors accountable. We also believe that this should be done while protecting all of the employers and independent contractors that play by the rules and follow the laws. As an association, we evaluate legislation through the lens of how it affects commercial contractors of all sizes, whether they are large, maybe more well-established, or if they're small and emerging businesses. We have been in communication with the authors. I want to thank Representative Greenman as well as the Department of Labor and Industry and appreciate the amendment adopted here today that begin to address some of our initial concerns, particularly surrounding the changes to that construction industry independent contractor test from that 9-factor test to a more detailed and expanded 14-factor. We are continuing to evaluate the bill in its entirety, particularly in light of that OLA report that you just heard about that was issued yesterday. Our members continue to have concerns with that test and complying with it, as well as that successor liability portion. We look forward to continuing to work with Representative Greenman and the department on those issues. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. And the folks who signed up ahead of time knew that they had 2 minutes, so hopefully you can...
I'll be brief.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Beshe. I'm here on behalf of Associated Builders and Contractors in Minnesota. Thanks for the opportunity to provide some brief comments on this bill. Our trade association is made up of 340 commercial and industrial contractors and their 20,000-plus employees. I do want to say that I appreciate that Representative Greenman met with us earlier this week to talk through some of the concerns that our members had, particularly as it relates to the 14-factor test, and we are appreciative of the amendment that appears as though it attempts to address some of those concerns. For the purpose of this committee's jurisdiction, I do want to just voice our opinion regarding the increased civil penalties. We do have concerns that there isn't much grace shown to unintentional or honest mistakes that an employer might make. So hopefully we can continue to discuss some options there. And then we do have continued concerns with the partnership. We can appreciate the need for increased interagency collaboration, but as written, one of the previous testifiers pointed out, we feel there is a lack of guardrails to ensure transparency and prevent abuses. So those are my comments for the purposes of this committee. Again, appreciate Representative Greenman working with us on the amendment, and but as of now, we continue to have concerns with the bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Any other members of the public wishing to testify? All right. Before we move on to member discussion, there are a couple amendments. So I think the first amendment we have is the A7. Representative Scott, is that your amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, that is my amendment, and I'll be speaking to the exemption from the Minnesota Data Practices Act in more detail with my questioning, but this would just say that this partnership entity needs to be subject to the Minnesota Data Practices Act. And I just want to cite for you throughout the bill all the places that this entity is going to be sharing or collecting information. Lines 2.3 through 2.10, lines 15.11 through 15.12, 15.15 through 15.17, 17.9, 17.24 to 17.25, 18.29 to 18.31, which includes Social Security numbers, 19.4 through 19.6, 20.5, 20.12, 20.14, 20 to 20.20, 20.22, and 21.10 to 21.22. And that's just one, in my cursory going through the bill, all the times that there's data sharing going on throughout this bill. And so, members, it's just really important when we're setting up a new entity like this to have some sunlight. And that's all I'm asking for is some sunlight on this. And so I would encourage a yes vote on the A7 and request a roll call, Madam Chair.
All right, roll call having been requested. Representative Greenman to the A7 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I'd ask at this point for you to vote no on this amendment. And I think as it is constructed and as it came out of both the OLA report and our conversations, the goal here with this partnership, it is not an entity. We are not creating a new government entity on purpose. What we're trying to do is bring the four agencies that have enforcement authority over misclassification. So that's deed for unemployment insurance, that's revenue for the tax implications, that's commerce for the commerce fraud division of workers' comp, and that's obviously Department of Labor and Industry for wage and hour and for some of the workers' comp piece, plus the Attorney General's office. It is bringing them together. What the OLA report said was if the legislature wants agencies to take a more active role in addressing worker misclassification, the legislature should direct the agencies to do so. And so this is the attempt. I think that from the conversations with Minkoji and others, very interested in working on language, our expectation is that the data protections that they exist with the agencies where the data lies would be the same ones coming in, as if in some ways some of this they can and should already do. The reason we're doing this partnership and the reason we're asking them to come back to us in January and tell us, you know, do we want to create a new entity or not? But where we are starting right now is saying we're going to pull all of these folks together. And so at this point, I'd ask you members, this has much bigger implications than just and it is, I think, read that the data has the protections of which or the classifications of which it lies. But if working on language and comfort language to clarify that, we can definitely do that, and we can put it on before taxes.
All right. Representative Niska to the A7.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn and Representative Greenman. I'd really be interested in hearing about those implications that are the reasons why we wouldn't do this. I mean, I think this language that we're adding in here doesn't accomplish anything other than create the kind of smoke screen potential that Mr. Ealing talked about. If you've ever been involved in any of this data practices action or litigation, I have been, and every tool in the toolbox that someone can use to within one of these agencies to prevent disclosure gets used. And so I hope you do work on some comfort language. It better be really, really good, because anytime we do as a legislature create the potential for ambiguity in this process, it's used over and over again to slow down transparency, to slow down the disclosure. If you've ever tried to work with any entity under the Data Practices Act, every tool in the book gets used, and I don't mean to impugn any particular agency. That's just the reality of how the Data Practices Act works in Minnesota. So I think we can solve this problem real quick here by just voting for the amendment. I don't understand why we wouldn't. But if we don't, the fix better be really, really good.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker Finn, Representative Greenman. I think it's important that we do have some sunlight on what's going on here. So who are the members of this commission? The Commissioner of Labor and Industry. The Commissioner of Revenue. The Commissioner of Employment and Economic Development. The Commissioner of Commerce. And the Attorney General. All state employees. Yet we're going to not have them be subjected to the open meeting law for the data practices. That's absolutely ridiculous. They're state employees acting on behalf of the state, and yet we're going to have them required to be part of the Data Practices Act. That's ridiculous. Please vote for this amendment.
Representative Greenman, and then I'll give Representative Scott the last word on her amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just note, and I didn't get all the sites that you shared, but the vast majority of this work, when you talk about sunlight, it's also really important that we're protecting investigatory data. That is why we are trying to leave it with the agencies and the classification with the agencies that have it. When we're talking about investigation, we are talking about things like Social Security numbers, tax information, UI information, business information. So I think that as we talk about comfort language, I think the idea that we'd be doing this to sow confusion, the whole point of this task force is to create some clarity. And so we're looking at language. I would ask members to vote against this amendment, but to protect the intention is that the data has the same classification as which it exists with the agency that holds it.
All right, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Greenman. I'm glad to hear that you're open to tweaking this. I have many concerns, and I know the carpenters were in the room and they testified. So these workers, all of their information is going to be shuffled from one agency to the next. They're going to be going over everything with a fine-tooth comb. And there's, if I'm not mistaken, and I will ask Mr. Hopkins here, if under the law, under this bill as it currently states the language, if a worker wants to find out what data this entity has on them, are they able to get that information since this isn't subject to the Data Practices Act?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, if this entity is not covered under the Government Data Practices Act, there is no right for an individual to request data about themselves from the entity.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Greenman, that should concern everyone in this room, this transparency piece is a two-way street. It's not just for making sure government is transparent, but making sure that and people whose data, very personal data in many ways, is being held by government have access to know with whom that data is being shared and what data is being held. So members, this should be a no-brainer for all of us. I don't think that the OLA's report, in fact, I wish the OLA was here so I could ask them, do you think this is a good idea? How are you going to audit and follow up if there's no data to follow up on to see if this is working or not? So members, I encourage a yes vote and again, the roll call. Thank you.
All right, the clerk will take the roll on Representative Scott's motion on the A7 amendment.
Chair Becker Finn.
No.
Vice Chair Frazier.
No.
Minority Leader Scott.
Yes.
Representative Carroll.
No.
Representative Curran.
No.
Representative Feist.
No.
Representative Fickey.
No.
Representative Frederick excused. Representative Grossel.
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Mueller?
No.
Representative Niska?
Yes.
Representative Weens excused. 4 ayes, 7 nays, 2 excused.
All right, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. Representative Scott, did you also want to do your A10 amendment?
Let's do it, Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. This just moves the effective date out. This is a 35-page bill. Businesses and this entity that is being created here need time to get up to speed. So this moves, this just says the effective date of this law would be July 1st, 2025.
All right.
I ask for member support and a roll call.
All right. Representative Greenman to the A10 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think if you look at the author's amendment we adopted, so I'd ask you to vote no against this amendment. There's pieces of this bill that can go into effect right away, like the partnership, which again is just pulling together the enforcement agencies. And I know that one of the reasons we want that to start right away is we want them to come back to us in next session and tell us about more about what they need to better enforce this law. But if in the amendment we adopt the effective date sort of specifically to deal with the contracting provision, the only test we changed is the contract provision. The general misclassification test, which applies to everybody else in the economy, does not change. And so the penalties and fees going up shouldn't affect the fact that people shouldn't break the law that currently exists. So for the issue, we did amend and are dealing with the effective date for the independent contractor test that changes. So for that, Madam Chair, I'd ask a no vote.
All right. Any further discussion to the A10? Any closing comments, Representative Scott? Seems pretty straightforward, but all right. Representative Scott moves the A10 amendment and has requested a roll call. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn?
No.
Vice Chair Frazier?
No.
Minority Leader Scott?
Yes.
Representative Carroll?
No.
Representative Curran?
No.
Representative Feist?
No.
Representative Finke?
No.
Representative Frederick excused. Representative Grossel?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Mueller?
No.
Representative Niska?
Yes.
Representative Weens excused. 4 ayes, 7 nays, 2 excused.
All right. The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. We will move on to member discussion of the bill. Any discussion to the underlying bill? Representative Scott.
Am I the only one, Madam Chair?
Well, I feel like we discussed the things within the jurisdiction of this committee via the amendments pretty well. But Representative Scott.
Thank you. How long do we have today, Madam Chair?
Well, some of us have public safety and not that long. So,
okay. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Greenman, on page 5, line 5.15, there's some language in there, may be held individually liable for engaging in. That language there, for engaging in. Is there a standard in law or court precedent for what engaging in means? Does it require direct participation in the prohibited activity? Or would this section be used against, like, a partner in a business, regardless of whether they were involved or not in the violation?
Representative Greenman, I think this was addressed in the A8 amendment that we adopted, but Representative Greenman, if you can explain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I'm understanding your question right, is the question engaging in prohibited activity, is that defined in statute? Is that is it engaging in and then we add the prohibited activity? Is that the question?
I would say it's moot because we deleted the language. The engaged in language was deleted. Representative Scott.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if we could just ask House Research for.
I don't know who wants to take that one.
Oh, okay. Moot point then, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right.
Oh, wait. What?
So the way that I can I.
Yes, Representative Greenman.
And I'm going to bring up the commissioner here, too. Just the way that it was amended was to say that in addition to the provision providing or performing building in construction contracting or improvement services in the course of a person's trade, business, occupation, or profession, or any owner, partner, principal member, officer, or agent who engaged in any of the prohibited activities in the subdivision. And so I think that my sort of follow-up question was, is the question what engaging in prohibited activities and is engaging a term of art?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, and maybe this is what the commissioner is going to say, but the addition of the word who, it specifies that it's a person that would have to have had direct knowledge of what was happening.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, that is correct. The person would have to be engaging in and doing the prohibited activity.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that clarifies, like, if it's a partner in the business and they have no idea, it falls on that. Okay. Thank you.
Great. Any further discussion to the underlying bill?
Yes, ma'am.
Representative Scott.
Yes. So I find it really interesting that the bill's author and this bill seems to be somewhat contradictory, because on 15.1, at the top of the page there on 15, partnership entity means any one of the following government entities with jurisdiction over employee misclassification of data. But then on 17.18, it says it's a non-entity. So we've got one piece of the puzzle here, one piece of the bill saying that, yes, indeed, this partnership is a government entity. And then in sub 5, 17.18 and 19, it's not. So either it is or it isn't. In my mind, it is a government entity, as we've already discussed. The Minnesota Data Practices Act, 13.02, sub 7, very beginning of the act, says government data means all data created, received, maintained, or disseminated by any government entity, regardless of its physical form, storage, media, or condition of use. So this is fundamental. This is a government entity by virtue of what 1302 says and by virtue of what this bill says. So that alone should require it to be subject to the Data Practices Act. So I'm interested in the bill's authors.
Yeah, and I'll just clarify, too, that the line on 17.19 is that it's not a state agency. Just want to make sure that's clear for the record, because on page 15, it uses the language government entity, and then on page 17, it says state agency. But Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott. And this is why we go through the committee process. I think that, to your point, it may be a confusing noun, and we could use a different noun. I think the goal, and if you look at how it's structured, is to take and ensure that we have the four agencies plus the one executive branch, the Attorney General's office, who have authority and investigatory powers over misclassification. That's sort of the response to, we have a very disjointed system where there's overlapping and sometimes concurrent investigations happening. The idea of a whole of government approach is not that we need to create another entity agency mechanism. The whole of government approach means if we have four agencies plus one executive branch enforcer who are all looking at the same thing, they should be working together. And so I hear you on the language, but I think that the intent is clear. And so I think that might be a good opportunity for taxes to think about another noun. It's not meant to be a term of art. It was just sort of meant to be the thing. I mean, we could have just called it the partnership. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, thanks. So again, 17.18, non-entity in bold print right there. But on page 15, government entity. I know that you have concerns about investigative data, and I know that you've mentioned that several times, and I listened to part of the tape from when this bill was in StateGov, and you mentioned that again. We're talking about more than just investigative data here. If you look on 17.20 and following under the duties, this partnership is to set goals Are the goals public? How will we know that they've been met? How will we know that they've been set? Number two there on 17.24, you're sharing all kinds of information. We've talked about that. On point three, develop a process or procedure that provides a person with relevant information and connects them with relevant partnership entities, regardless of which partnership entity that person contacts for assistance. Okay, is the process that's used to create a process and procedure going to be, why shouldn't that be made public? You're doing best practices, why shouldn't that be made public? Identify resources needed for better enforcement of employee misclassification. Again, this kind of goes to why can't we at least make the minutes of these meetings public so the public has an idea and the stakeholders, quite frankly, have an idea of if this entity is doing what it says and is required by this new bill law to do. Inform and educate stakeholders. There's all sorts of duties of this entity that aren't investigative data. It's other forms of data that should be made public. I'm not advocating for investigative data to be made public until after the investigation is over, and then laws that are current would apply. But I think this is just very problematic. I feel like this bill it's several powerful government agencies coming together to enforce, and their actions and the data should have some sunlight. Otherwise, this is like unchecked power, and I think that could be super problematic, and I think it's wrongheaded to try to carve out this entity from every other area of government that's subject to this except for the judicial branch. And if Mary Liz Holberg were here today, she'd say, what makes you so special, right? That this should be carved out. So members, I know we're not going to win the vote on this. I do ask for a roll call. But I hope that you will take these comments into consideration, Representative Greenman. I'm happy to work with you. I know Minkoji is as well. No government entity should have some smokescreen, as Representative Niska alluded to. This is just not the way to do things. And I, again, as I stated before too, that this issue used to be a very bipartisan issue, and we have a bipartisan data practices commission, and people make it sound good in the commission like it's bipartisan, but it's not turned out to be that in the last few years, and that's really disappointing, because that commission was started by one Democrat and one Republican who came together and said, this is stuff that is important to the way our government works, and it should be, you know, it should be reviewed by a separate entity to look at what's best policy, best practices policy, and this doesn't fall into best practices.
All right, closing comments, Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, thank you, Representative Scott. I am, as I said, I think the whole goal of the partnership, which is just one piece of this bill, is to bring those enforcing in those entities, and I think to the extent that it makes sense, I think we should clarify that, again, the current laws that apply to the folks at the table continue to apply. What I will say is that what also should be nonpartisan is a commitment that when workers are getting cheated out of their unemployment insurance, their social security, or excuse me, their unemployment insurance, their workers' comp, their wage and hour laws, their right to form a union, paid family and medical leave, and their right to actually have some rights on the job as it relates to discrimination, those pieces that government should be able to enforce that. That is an issue of taxpayer dollars that are cheated, that the government's being cheated out of. That's an issue of workers being cheated. So I hope and I look forward to the conversation where we have bipartisan support for our workers and our social safety net. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion to recommend that House File 4444, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Taxes. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn.
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Aye.
Minority Leader Scott.
No.
Representative Carroll.
Aye.
Representative Curran.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Finke. Yes. Representative Frederick excused. Representative Crossland.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Niska.
No.
Representative Weens excused. 7 ayes, 4 nays, 2 excused.
All right. With that, the motion prevails and the bill is on its way to taxes. With that, we are adjourned.